And welcome back to this edition of Sports Talk. Doug Miles along with Don Henderson with you today. And Don, I'm going to let you introduce our special guest.
Well, we do have a special guest. Jim Cott has been kind enough to join us a couple of times now on different shows, and really a pleasure to have him on. Wish we had a day and a half to talk about all the things that he's done, but we're going to try to limit it down to 15 or 20 minutes. First of all, Jim, the latest guy going into the Hall of Fame, 283 wins, a long time coming. And Jim, I'll tell you, first of all, as I said to you a couple of weeks ago, congratulations on the Hall of Fame number one. And let me ask a question, because so many people talk about this. Was there a lot of anxiety on your part as you knew that another vote was coming up, whether it was the senior committee or whether it was the regular? How did you face it each time there was a ballot coming up?
Well, Don, I think in my early days that I was eligible, I was more curious. My win total was right there with Fergie Jenkins and Robin Roberts, but I wasn't the dominant pitcher they were. So I was curious how the writers would judge that, and I soon found out that I think starting pitchers had to really be the number one ace, dominant, perennial all-stars, opening day starters, et cetera. I didn't fall into that category. I did. My career was more done with longevity over a long period of time. And then with the Veterans Committee, when I just missed a couple times, I realized that they had a lot of voters on that committee that really weren't involved in baseball when I was active. And so this last time, I thought with Fergie Jenkins and Joe Torre and John Schuerholz, some of the guys on that committee, I thought, well, I'm going to get the fairest hearing that I've ever had. And I made it right on the number. So I felt not confident, but I felt a little more that I had a pretty good chance this time.
The interesting part to me was, and I'm not a great guy for numbers and all, but at times I have to use them. And 300 pitchers have won more than 250 games from 1935 until today. Only 47 of those have won 250 games, inclusive of going into the Hall of Fame, including Pettit, who got in. He was the 251st. So only 47 pitchers out of all that time. And if I'm a voter, sometimes you have to, I think you have to use some numbers. The chances of somebody going in with 283 wins, seems to me it ought to be secure over all that length of time, whether you were a long-distance starting pitcher or whether you pitched a lot of games and won them. No matter how you got there, you won 283 games.
Well, I think a fellow on that committee, in addition to Fergie, who was very supportive of me, was Steve Hurt, who has the kind of numbers that you're mentioning. Steve and his family kind of ran the Elias Sports Bureau. So he did a lot of comps of pitchers that were in there and kind of compared my record to their record. And I think that's what some of the writers, mainly the former writers and the executives that maybe weren't quite aware of that, it could have swayed their opinion. So you're right. There is a time when numbers can be of value.
Doug, I'll let you jump in before I get back on tour with Jim Cott, our special guest here this afternoon. Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, thanks, Don. And Jim, great to have a chance to talk with you. When you get to the Hall of Fame, I know you've been on several teams. Do you get to choose which team you go in at?
No, I think the Hall of Fame, I believe they have the final say, but it was pretty much a no-brainer for me because the majority of my career was with the Twins.
Right.
They retired my number that year. And my most enjoyable year in baseball was 1982 with the Cardinals, when we won the World Series. But I think I'm more known and my career was more identified with the Twins.
I think you could also talk about the difference, exactly what you were referring to in our first segment. And Bob Gibson had 255 complete games in 17 years and only 251 wins. He had more complete games than he had wins. So if you compare those to your numbers of the 283 that you won, you're exactly right. The starting pitchers, they gave a lot more credit to because of the number of innings and the number of wins they got.
Yeah, I think in my era, like when I was a kid, when I, you know, I kind of fell in love with baseball in the mid-40s when my dad took me to a game in Detroit. And when I began to follow the game, the big attraction were the starting pitcher matchups. My dad drove to Cleveland one time to see a doubleheader with the Indians and Yankees, and he saw Reynolds and Rashi and Feller and Lemon. You know, and those were – that's what stood out is the starting pitchers, whereas today – I mean, I think pretty quick owners are going to realize that they're paying this big money for starters that are only going to pitch 4 or 5 innings. I mean, they're wasting their money, really, because the starting pitcher doesn't have an influence on the outcome of the game as much as they did years ago. So, you know, based on that, that was I played, you know, positions as a young kid, amateur ball, but I always thought the cool thing to be in the big leagues was to be a starting pitcher.
Doug?
Jim, I had a chance recently on YouTube. They put up the entire 1965 World Series, the actual NBC broadcasts, and had a chance to watch all the games. Really was a great World Series, obviously, not for the Twins, obviously. He lost Game 7 to Koufax because he was just unhittable that day. But your memories of that series, and I guess you pitched 3 times in that series, right?
Yeah, I remember, you know, in those days, the only game on TV was the weekend game with Pee Wee Reese and Dizzy Dean. So, and it was Saturday afternoon. So when that game was on TV, every team was playing. So I never really had a chance. I never met Sandy Koufax. I never saw him pitch until I was like 30 feet away from him warming up in the bullpen for game 2. And, that was so impressive. I remember telling Johnny Sain after the first couple innings of game 2, we were still scoreless. I said, John, if I give up a run, this game's over. Nobody can touch this guy. And we were lucky we got a couple of runs off Sandy. One of them was unearned. And then Drysdale pinch hit for him in the 7th, and that was the last run we got off. Sandy shut us out in game 5, shut us out in game 7. So. You know, it was sad to lose, although at that time we felt like we were a team that was going to be back a lot, and we weren't. But it was quite an honor when I look back and go again, say that I went against Sandy 3 times, because I think during my career he probably was the greatest pitcher. Gibby, Marischal, Seaver, they're right there with him. But I think what stood out with Sandy is the Dodgers didn't really have a potent offense. So he
well, won it was interesting.
Games. Yeah, 2-1, 3-2.
It was interesting that we did a lot of shows with Tim McCarver, a good friend of yours as well. In fact, you won your last 2 Gold Gloves as a pitcher with the Philadelphia Phillies, number 17 and 18. And but at the same time, he told before he passed away, and of course he lived down here in Sarasota. We had a chance to see a lot, did a lot of shows with us. And he said his 2 greatest friends were Bob Gibson, and he just thought that Sandy Koufax was the second pitcher. He always thought right. That Gibson. We had a lot of arguments, not arguments. I shouldn't say that. Difference of opinion about who was the greatest pitcher for one game, whether you take Bob Gibson or whether you take Sandy Koufax. And
I couldn't argue with Timmy on that. I was very close to Timmy. As a matter of fact, I was holding his hand when he passed away in Memphis. Gosh, time flies now. It was a year and a half ago.
Right.
But when we had lunch together one day, Timmy and Bob Gibson and myself, and of course, you didn't become a friend of Gibby's unless you were a Cardinal. You know, he was very. If you weren't a Cardinal, you were nothing. So. We had lunch together, and Timmy pointed out, I think there was a period in 68 where Bob pitched 9 consecutive complete games. 8 of them were shutouts. They were not in a row, but 8 of the 9 were shutouts. And during that 9-game period of time, he gave up 1 run and he knocked in 2 himself. So I can understand why he would say that about Gibby. And, you know, in Sandy's case, if he were able to pitch, you know, 6-7 more years, would he have been as dominant? I don't know. You know, he what stood out is those 4 dominant years he had from 63 through 66, maybe even 62 in there as well. But he was just so dominant compared to the other pitchers. But I think you can mention Marichal, Sandy, and Bob Gibson would be at the top, and then you have Marichal and Tom Seaver, and you can't overlook Steve Carlton with one of the greatest individual years that any pitcher's ever had. So
27 wins for a terrible. He played for a terrible team to win 27 games. I'll tell you that. Right. I saw most of them.
Yeah.
And you're right, Steve Carlton was the other. He talked about those two pitchers, Steve Carlton and Bob Gibson. And Doug, you're up.
Jim, you alluded to it before about the starting pitching really now only going a few innings. But just wanted to ask you, we talked about pitchers like Seaver and Gibson and Carlton and Koufax. They threw hard, but not every pitch was thrown hard. They had the art of pitching, moving the ball around. Do you see... by today's standards, you see these guys just trying to throw every pitch through a brick wall. We've seen the injuries to kind of back that up, causing injuries. Your thoughts on kind of pitching today as opposed to pitching years ago?
I think the big difference is somewhere along the line with the radar guns, and which is one of the worst things that's happened to pitching because it's so deceptive anyway. Pitchers don't really throw as fast as that radar gun says, but I think that all of a sudden there was pressure on young kids to chase velocity in order to get a college scholarship. And Greg Maddux and several others have said it correctly. We chased execution of pitches and control of pitches. And today it's throw it as hard as you can. And half the time they don't know where it's going. And then unfortunately they end up on the operating table. So it really isn't pitching today as much as it is throwing. And it's kind of disappointing to see because it's wasting a lot of great talent, guys that have strong arms. And, like Lucas Giolito just went down with the Red Sox. He's going to earn $37 million the next 2 years. He may not throw a pitch. He's 29 years old. And I just don't think they get the enjoyment out of being a starting pitcher and having an influence on the game as we did back in the 60s and 70s.
Well, Jim, a couple of things that I'd like to touch with you. Number one, people that I think should have been in the Hall of Fame long ago and like you had a long wait. Maybe they're not going to live long enough to get there. And Bill White would be one. I talked to Bill a few weeks ago. We did a show with him not too long ago. And Bill lives right here in Pennsylvania, where I normally live in New Jersey, but I'm down here in Sarasota right now. But Bill missed by one vote, and I just can't imagine how, with the years of baseball experience between San Francisco, the Cardinals, the Phillies, his years in the booth, 17 with the Yankees, his years in the front office of baseball, first colored announcer or black announcer on network TV, and first in New York with the New York Yankees, and you worked with him many years there. How he's not in the Hall of Fame, I have no idea. How Dick Allen is not in the Hall of Fame, I know there were a lot of things against Dick and the things that he did, and you saw him in Philadelphia too. I'd like you to comment, first of all, on Bill White, second of all, on Dick Allen, and why you don't think they're in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I was really disappointed in Bill's case, and like you, I'm good. Bill is my broadcast mentor, and Billy Cordell hooks me up with him occasionally. We have a chance to chat, but the influence he had, coming after Jackie Robinson and kind of forcing the hotel owners in Florida to begin to accept black players as well as the white players, he had such an influence there. And then with his playing career and his announcing and his executive career, I just think it's a case where maybe a lot of the voters don't do their homework and don't realize. I mean, he belongs in there before some of the commissioners that were voted in. And I hope that someday I'm on a committee that gets a chance to state his case, as I think I will be next year for Tommy John. Dick missed by one vote. If you could vote for five instead of four, I think Dick may have been on in the same year that I was. And I wish he was, because I feel the same way you do. Tommy John, there are a couple of others. I think Dale Murphy gets overlooked a lot. So it's hard to determine why some of the voting committees don't understand what great careers these guys had.
Well, my first growing up as a young fella and following the Cincinnati Reds for a bit, I always felt all during the election time that Early Lombardi was another one that fell into that category. He finally got in, but at the same time, it was 7 or 8 years after he died. And they kept saying, well, Ernie Lombardi played during the war. Hey, he won 2 batting titles before the war ever started. Yeah. and he played 17 years, and he batted 315, and he was probably the best catcher of his era. I mean, I don't know how many catchers are in the Hall of Fame, but Ernie Lombardi deserved to go in a hell of a lot faster than what they finally put him in. But and as I say, Dick Allen, there was a lot of controversy about Dick, but the numbers are still there. I whether you like Dick or whether you don't like Dick, the numbers are there.
Well, you know, if Dick Allen had come up with the Cardinals and been there with Gibson and Brock and Kurt Flood, some of the other black players, it would have made a life a lot easier for him. But being the only black player in Philadelphia, in a city that did not warmly accept their black athletes, that made it very difficult for Dick. And, you know, it weighed on him mentally, and I think that really affected him in a negative way. You know, I was honored to be his teammate in Chicago and then again in Philadelphia, and certainly when you look at what he did on the field, he was a little bit like Henry Aaron in that Henry did what he did without a lot of flash. And Dick learned how to play the game under Gene Mock. So he didn't play it for statistics. You know, he played it if there's a man on second, nobody out, he was going to hit a ground ball the other way and advance the runner. So he did a lot of those things, great base runner, that don't show up in the box score. And sometimes when people just look at the numbers, they overlook it.
Jim, you're exactly right about the starting pitchers. I got to see Robin Roberts pitch a lot, of course, being close to Philadelphia and growing up in that area. And at one time, he had 28 straight complete games. I don't know how many people are going to match up against Robin Roberts during the course of his career. And going back to Cincinnati and Ernie Lombardi, Johnny Vandermeer pitched those 2 back-to-back no-hitters. He got into the Hall of Fame, as I said, after he died in 1986. He died in 1977. But, Jim, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Just a tremendous honor on our part having you with us.
All right. Thank you, and we'll do it again sometime.
I hope so. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Bye.